What you are hearing is the sound of a glass blowing video in super slow-mo. Orange sparks fly off a glowing orb at the end of a metal poker. It looks like a scene from outer space. The guy doing the glass blowing, Tyler Kimball, wears safety goggles as he sits down to polish his almost finished piece. And the polishing process turns those sparks into giant flames. It is quite a show. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and Tyler Kimball is here now. His glass art has taken him to other cities with bigger glass scenes, but after 17 years away, he came back here and started a studio for himself and other artists here in town. And now they're putting on a glass festival that starts today, the Heartland Glass Festival. Tyler Kimball, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Gina.
Tell me about the festival.
Well, it's an art show. It is called Heartland Glass. This is the third year running, and it is the region's best glass that's happening. There's 16 pieces, and there's some museum quality work in this show. It was juried down from 42 submissions, which was great to see that kind of showing of submissions. And the opening is from 6 to 9 tonight. And there's going to be a glass-blowing demonstration, so you can see what you were just describing there and the process of glass-blowing, as well as a lot of different techniques are going to be exhibited in the show, from fusing to some stained glass, things like that. So there's all the techniques are in the show.
Glass art, I mean, it can have a reputation for being like people who want to make their own pipes.
Yeah, and that's a bit of a stigma in the glassblowing world. Flame workers oftentimes will refer to themselves as glassblowers, and it can be a little tricky that way. And their main scene is the pipe scene, and it is becoming more of an art form. There's a real technique to it. But what we do is a little more historical. It's larger scale. It's vases. It's bowls. It's large figures and things like that, a lot more sculptural. And not to say that pipe making isn't a skill, but it's not something we do a lot of.
It's just like a narrow range of what is out there in the
Correct.
Glass art world.
Yeah, absolutely.
What do you make?
Every day is just a little bit different. So sometimes we're making glasses and barware, pretty traditional things to make. We also make some fine art pieces at Monarch, and then larger scale installations as well. We've done some hospitals. We have some things coming up that might be some larger scale installations. Some lighting is wonderful. Glass loves light. It really shows off how beautiful it can be. It also can
show. So when you say lighting, you're talking about lighting fixtures.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Yeah, so pendant lighting, chandeliers, these are all pretty typical things to do with glass. And, you know, it can be really, really exciting work can happen around a light source with glass. So,
light loves glass, or I can't remember whether you said light loves glass or glass loves light.
They love each other. Or they can hate one another. If it's poorly made glass, light can exhibit that the poor glass. But it can really exhibit nice glass very well, so.
What is it that you love about glass? There are these moments, even in the short time we've been talking, where you just, like, your enthusiasm about this material is really apparent.
The finished look of glass is like no other. It's got this kind of transparency to it. It's, you know, got this shine and brilliance that no other material can capture. It's also the process of glass blowing. It's got this kind of zen feel to it where, you know, you are one with that glass being formed. And it's also a really communal thing where it's not as singular of an art form as a lot of the other ones, where you have to have a team around you. You got to communicate with people, and everybody is working on this piece, and you're all becoming one surrounding this one piece. So it's got this really nice, you know, feel as it's being made. And then in its finished look, it looks great too.
Can you describe that process just for as a non-glass blower myself, I can kind of picture it. You know, I've seen the demonstrations with, like, there are torches and there are sparks, but what is it that you're all actually doing so communally?
Well, it starts with the glass furnace. So just melting the batch into the glass and then gathering out of that furnace onto a blowpipe, and then entering the air in. And you actually, you know, it's all mouth blown, so it's all very, you know,
it's organic.
Yeah, and it's a 2,000-year-old craft. So it is something that you're kind of walking in the steps of history while you're doing it. And yeah, you've got to have a partner blow for you, so you got to communicate when it's time to blow. You're watching the glasses, you're using the hand tools to expand it and catch it in certain areas. And then oftentimes you'll transfer it over onto another rod, which is called a punty, and then you'll open that up and turn it into a cup or a vase or anything like that. Or you can get a lot more sculptural, and you can really focus the heat in certain areas with hot torches and things like that.
This might sound like an insane question, but what is glass? As I'm listening to you, you know, wood, it's the stuff from trees. Clay is the stuff from under the ground. Glass, scientifically, like, what is it?
It's silica sand, soda ash, and lime are the main components. And then you add some different metals to it, and it turns into a different colored glass. But that's exactly what captured me about glass when I was young, is that, you know, it's just sort of, it's not naturally produced. It is, when lightning hits sand, it can turn into fragulite.
Whoa!
Yeah, and it's a pretty cool natural phenomenon, but it doesn't occur as easily as something like wood or, you know, clay.
And yet it's everywhere.
Well, we've created it. And it's really taken off with the invention of clear glass a long time ago. It made a lot of advances in civilization, and it is everywhere, and we've gotten better at making it where we can use tin floats to make float glass, which is the windows that we see now that basically look like they're not even there. So it's all around us.
How did you first discover glass? I mean, you said that one of the things that first drew you to it was that it was not naturally occurring. But can you take me to that time in your life?
Yeah. When I first noticed it, I was a young child looking at a stained glass window, and just exactly what we were just talking about, not understanding how that was made by human hands.
Where was this stained glass window?
It was in my mom and dad's house, and one of the little prismatic rainbows caught a light on the ground, and I went and looked where it came from, and that's what captured me first about glass.
Wow, that's really cool. Because yeah. I think most people have some kind of a memory, whether they can pinpoint exactly when and where it was, of seeing light streaming in through a window and being kind of awestruck.
Yeah, definitely. It is. And stained glass in churches for many centuries, that's the reason for having them there. It's got this sort of emotional feel to it when light streams through glass.
I've heard you say in a Creative Mornings talk, I've heard you say that it was hard to find glass in Kansas City growing up.
Yeah. Without YouTube, glass was not here. Now with the wonders of YouTube.
Like glass making as a process and an artistic thing, you could sort of find an entry point into.
Right. There's nothing really here in Kansas City until now, where someone who's interested in glass can go and learn more about it, can watch it happening, and just, you know, wonder and learn about it. And so that is one of the reasons I brought glass back to Kansas City. But also, yeah, YouTube and Instagram these days are great to be able to watch the process. And when I was growing up, that was not available. So I just had to, you know, go to the library and look at pictures and things like that. But
do you think that the inaccessibility of it maybe kind of made it, I don't know, this like thing you can't have and want so bad? Do you think that might have intensified your passion?
Maybe, yeah. I mean, it definitely led me to explore more, and it had me moving out to Seattle to learn as much as I could, where it's really, you know, saturated out there, but it had me moving away to gather as much knowledge as I could. Yeah,
that's a lot of confidence to have that this is your calling when you haven't had much of a chance to try your hand at it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I just jumped right at it. It was something that I actually went to school for creative writing, and then on my off time started to mess around with glass, and I embraced it more and more as I worked with it.
Can I jump in here and say, yeah, in my off time, I started to mess around with glass?
Okay.
Can you explain that? Because that sounds like I could just, like, if I wanted to learn how to jump rope, I can get that. Like, I get a jump rope and I just do that on my own when I have some time, get better at it. Glass, it doesn't seem like that's, like, how it works.
Right. So how I started was in stained glass, which, you know, it's kind of a thing where you put aside a project, whereas in glass blowing, you are all in. But
yeah, because you could, like, really hurt yourself if you're just sort of playing around.
Yeah, exactly. So it took a little while for me to be all in. But when I was getting engaged with it, it was something that I was, you know, it was a hobby for me, and it grew and took over my life. But
so in Seattle, how did you tell me about the beginning of your journey as a serious glass maker, glass artist?
So I actually moved to Seattle and started working at a stained glass studio, which was great. That's why I moved there. And I was actually carving those bevels out at this stained glass studio, which we were just talking about. And that led me to be able to both carve glass and polish glass, which in the hot glass world is called a cold worker. And that allowed me to get a part-time job at a hot glass studio named Glass Eye Studio.
What is the difference between hot glass and cold glass? I'm sorry. This is all fairly unfamiliar.
Yeah. Hot glass is glass blowing. It's anything where the glass is up at 2100 degrees, 2200 degrees. You know, warm glass, we'll consider anything that's kiln formed, so it's right around 1500 degrees. Cold glass, you're touching it. You're doing stained glass. You're doing, you know, assembling. You're carving glass.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Go on.
Okay. Then I started working part time at this glass blowing studio, Glass Eye Studio, and from the cold shop during my lunch breaks, I started going in and messing around with the hot glass.
Again.
Yes.
Just I'm worried on your behalf hearing you say this.
I had some of my coworkers, you know, leading me in the right direction.
But what was that like? Was it scary? Big torch?
It's like everyone who takes their first gathers, and it's inspiring. It's scary. It's you're awestruck by the glass, and you got to remember, you got to keep on turning it because you're watching this thing happen in your hands. But so during these lunch breaks, you know, I really started getting more comfortable working with this, you know, hot moving liquid. And the lead blower there did see that I was getting more comfortable with it and asked me to join the hot glass team. That's how I got into the glass blowing side, was kind of the back door of the hot glass world.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
You must have been so excited when someone saw this in you too and took you seriously in that way.
It was an exciting day for me for sure. And I think I called my mother and I said, I'm going to be a glass blower. And then she said to me, oh, and I'm a redhead and everything. My mother says, oh, but honey, your complexion, because you're standing in front of these blazing fires and things. But it was at that point, I did know it was what I was going to do for the rest of my life.
So it is interesting to me that you had this almost mentorship kind of experience in a way, because that seems to be a lot of what you are doing with your studio here.
Yeah, and it's been done for years in the glassblowing world, where you can't just know what to do. You have to be guided. Someone has to help you learn new techniques, get comfortable with what you're doing. And so, yeah, that's exactly what I'm doing. And everyone on the Monarch crew, everybody grows and gets better and more familiar with the material, myself included. Every day that we work in it, we're getting better and better and understanding the material and what we can do with it more. So,
can you tell me a little bit about the moment when you decided it was time for you to come back to Kansas City to start your own studio and invite others to be a part of it?
Yeah, I had a 5-year plan in place to move back, and I actually jumped on it a little earlier and got back here and started setting up the studio. It was it was my goal to get back to Kansas City. And
from the time you left?
Not from the time I left, no. But as I got, you know, more familiar with the material and more familiar with building equipment and could see myself running a studio, that's where it was leading me to, was
back home.
That's
so cool. Yeah. So you made this five-year plan. What does a five-year plan to start a glass-blowing studio entail?
Oh, I don't know. It's been a while. But, yeah, I mean, first things first, get back to Kansas City. And then after that, find the right building that's going to be a nice building to house a studio. And
that seems like it would be a challenge in and of itself, because what you need in a space where you're going to be using torches and such,
yeah,
strikes me as specific.
It is a concrete building. It is masonry and concrete, and it is a very specific building that I was looking for. And an old abandoned elevator shaft makes for a great evacuation of heat. So that was, when I walked into that building, I knew that was the building for a good glassblowing studio.
And you've called your studio Monarch Glass Studio. Can you talk about that name?
Yeah, it's three blocks away from where the Kansas City Monarchs used to play. And I'm a huge baseball fan and Royals fan, and I thought it nice, especially being in the 18th and Vine District, to kind of, you know, pay tribute to the area with the name. And there's also a secondary background to that, where a mentor of mine calls me the Rondell King, which is a type of blown disc that I've been making for a long time, and so that King nickname kind of stuck.
The Kansas City part of your roots, though, and the reference to the part of town where the studio is, seems significant.
It is, very much so. And I have really embraced that neighborhood and the community. Everyone around there is great, and we're getting together and kind of bringing life back into an area that's not been forgotten, but not paid enough attention.
So tell me about the community of glass blowers who are working with you.
Well, there's five of us at Monarch Glass Studio, but we have a large community of people who have taken classes and then have gotten really into it and have been renting time there. So there's probably about 25 people who use the studio as their place to make glass. And so it's just been growing every year, and that community's getting bigger, and everybody's getting better with what they want to do with glass. So it's great to see it evolve.
Is there, would you say that there is what you would call a legit glass community, glass scene in Kansas City at this point?
It's small, but there's a small spark that could turn into a nice big flame here soon.
I see what you did there.
with just more people knowing about it and people continuing and pushing their limits within glass. And yeah, I think Kansas City can grow.
Tell me more about, like, a favorite piece that is in the show that's opening today. It's in your space, right? The show?
Yeah, it's in the gallery space. I've got to say, my favorite piece is Patrick Martin's piece, and it is absolutely, absolutely amazing technically, and just the how it looks. It's engaging. It's all clear glass, where there's nowhere to hide in clear glass. But the shape is great, and it's actually, and I'll tell you, it's two large neurons, which a neuron shape is not an easy one to make in glass, but it's great.
A neuron shape is not an easy one to make in glass. Tell me about some of the other, I mean, you've said that this is a regional show showing the best glass work in the region. Mm-hmm. Do you think that other Midwestern cities have the same kind of situation as Kansas City, where there has not maybe historically been a giant community and it's people like trying to get that off the ground?
You know, Third Degree in St. Louis has done a lot. But for the most part, you know, we're so spread out here in the Midwest, it's hard to connect with other studios and build a community. But there's, you know, Kansas City is the perfect spot for it, because there's so much going on with the arts. And Seen some other artists using mainly other materials, seeing them use glass, it's nice to see them get engaged with glass as well. So, yeah.
What do you think, if you had to, like, state what the goal is, like, how will you know when you have accomplished in Kansas City what you hoped to accomplish here?
I don't know. It's never ending. I think we can continue to grow and learn and make work and discover what we can do with glass. So there's never an end to it.
And this weekend is the beginning of this festival, which goes through into May.
Yeah, May 11th. So the opening's from 6 to 9 tonight, and then it will run through May 11th. And any of the open hours that Monarch is open is fine to come in if you can't make it to the opening tonight.
Tyler Kimball of Monarch Glass Studio, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Tyler's organized the Heartland Glass Festival. It starts today, continues through May 15th at their building on Truman Road. Up next, the first movie to take advantage of Kansas City's new incentives for filmmakers stars an actor originally from Kansas City, David Desmulchin. We will be chatting with him in just a second. Stay tuned to KCUR's Central Standard. In a new movie called All Creatures Here Below, actor and KC native David Desmulchin plays a down-on-his-luck guy named Jensen who just lost his job at a pizza joint in L.A. His girlfriend just lost her job, too, a cleaning job at a church. That these two people are unstable, really traumatized, and in trouble is clear. Exactly what the real problem is not, at least not yet. But Ruby's been waiting at home for Jensen for a while when...
What? Oh, where you been?
What's wrong?
Where you been? I was worried about you. Where were you? Mr. Steele told me they're closing your restaurant.
I don't care.
I was trying to call you. Didn't you hear me calling you?
Nope.
Jensen is wild-eyed and erratic, not even looking at Ruby.
I'm sorry about my job.
You ain't gotta worry about that anymore.
I need to tell you something. I did something. Jen, I need to tell you something.
Okay.
Jen.
Please stay. I gotta go out for a couple hours. When I come back, everything is gonna be good, I promise.
As you might guess, everything is not good in a couple of hours, as Jensen promises it will be. And what Ruby did, the thing she was trying to tell him about just now, is pretty bad. So the couple ends up on the run, and they seek refuge in their hometown, Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman, and one of the co-stars of this movie is on the line with us now, David Desmulchin. Hello.
Good morning, Gina. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Excellent. Excited to be talking to you. Hi, Kansas City.
Your movie credits include films like The Dark Knight and Blade Runner 2049. You are no stranger to making movies, but you wrote this movie on top of starring in it. What was it like to be here in your hometown filming a really personal movie?
It was like, you know, that phrase, like all the feelings. It was all the feelings. It was terrifying and it was scary and it was totally invigorating. And it had this incredible, like, full circle kind of moment. I had many of those moments, but a full circle experience for me because as with all of us, our childhoods in the place that we grow up are shaped by so many things, good, bad, positive, negative. We're haunted by things. We're inspired by things. So to go back home, and by the way, Gina, like 20 years since I've really spent significant amount of time in Kansas City, the city has just, it's grown so much. And it was, that part of it was incredible for me too, to get to explore a place that I thought I knew and all of a sudden be like, well, this feels like in many regards, a new city to me. So it was incredible. It's hard to, sorry if I'm rambling.
No,
it's hard to like
great.
Sum up in words, but yeah, it was, I'll probably never have an experience like that again in my life. It was, and I had my little boy with me. He was only, I believe, 2 when we went to shoot it. And my wife, Eve, was with me. And so going back to the place also where I was raised with now my own kid and making a film about, you know, generational issues and parenting and et cetera, it was intense.
We just did, speaking of intense, we heard a very intense, pivotal scene from the movie in your character's apartment, and I didn't totally explain what was going on. Who are these characters, Ruby and Jensen? What are they up against?
So, you know, these are people that that are survivors, and there's darkness in their past and in both of their childhoods that is just, you know, atrocious. And to flee that and to flee kind of the unfair advantage that they had, because they weren't put through like traditional school, they were kind of kept out of society in a lot of ways as kids, they fled because Jensen had this dream of becoming, you know, the next Fred Durst, the next rap rocker, the next, you know, star. And so they went when they could, and they fled to California, where they've been living and suffering and struggling. And, you know, his job at the pizza shop has now been terminated because they're going to corporatize this mom and pop restaurant chain. And her job has been eliminated at the church because Ruby, for reasons that we will come to understand if you get to see the film, is just can't seem to keep away from children. She's got this very sweet and yet kind of haunting attraction to wanting to take care of children and protect children. And so, needless to say, with that scene that you guys just heard, and it was so weird hearing it because I just feel like I'm listening to another person, and I'm like, oh, that's me. Is everything is set in motion when they both basically take the things that they feel have always been denied them. And for Jensen, that is a chance at financial security, and for Ruby, that is a child of her own. And so they have to go back to Kansas City because that's the only place that they know where they can go hide from this huge mistake they've done. The problem is going back there is also the thing that they fear the most.
Well, so yeah, because going back to the place where it all happened, the scene of the crime. Growing up in Kansas City, how did you get into movies and acting?
Oh, boy. So I went to Oak Park Elementary School in Overland Park, Kansas. And I remember my brother, you know, was Captain Hook in the sixth grade play at Oak Park. And then when I got to sixth grade, Carol Hayden, Jack Haupt, they put me in this play and I stood on stage in this costume and it was it for me. I also used to watch the Cremation Mortem creature feature on Channel 41 in Kansas City. And I fell in love with all my favorite actors, Lon Chaney and Chaney Jr. and Peter, you know, Loring, Boris Karloff. Then, you know, you get into junior high and high school, and I was doing shows at Shawnee Mission Theater in the Park, and you start reading, you know, we didn't have the internet back then. So it was like, I'd read about people like, you know, Jim Jarmusch and David Lynch in like The Pitch or whatever. And you'd start figuring out what is this? Because even the video shop, I didn't know exactly where to go. So I'd go to Tivoli and I just started discovering cinema. I mean, all of us, I'm sure you, me, everybody listening, the power of cinema was prevalent since we were kids. The first time you saw Ghostbusters or Muppet Movie or Indiana Jones, Star Wars, that was already hugely influential over me. But then seeing, you know, art house filmmakers and the places where I would see them around Kansas City, it was incredible, man. So that all drove me. And then I got into high school and I had two incredible drama teachers. Mark Swayze was our rep teacher and Kathy Wood was my forensics coach. And they said to me, if you want to do this, like pursue this as a real job, we think you could do it. And that's a crazy thing for a kid from Kansas City to have his teachers tell him like that they actually think he has a shot at doing this. And I thank God every day that they did say that, because I didn't have the confidence then to go to Chicago and train as a serious actor, you know. So
in a way, who would?
Yeah, exactly. I know, you have to be a little bit crazy to jump into this insane industry and to pursue a life of an actor, and luckily I had so much support, not to mention my family and friends. And you know, Kansas City was just the perfect incubator for me as a storyteller, because it's so odd that I think Kansas City is right in the center of the country, because to me it is, in more regards than geographically, the center of the country, especially Kansas City itself. You've got left, right, blue, red. You've got very religious. You've got not religious at all. You've got all different forms of, you know, art and expression. And it was just, I couldn't have been raised in a better place to want to do what I've grown up to do.
Your role in The Dark Knight playing Thomas Schiff was your breakout moment. Can you tell the story of how that happened?
Yes, it was. Back to Kansas City, I used to escape into the magic of a place called Clint's Comics. And I've been a comic book collector since I was a kid. And so I was in Chicago, and I was so grateful, Gina, because I was making my living, and maybe a meager one, but I was actually had started to support myself as a theater actor in Chicago, one of the greatest theater cities in the world. And I was doing great shows, working with great people. And but my that dream of like movies and filmmaking was starting to feel like maybe that was always going to be just that, a dream. And you know, with every industry, but especially I feel like with acting, writing, and the arts, it's like you can work really hard, hopefully have some talent, but that lucky moment is still so necessary. And for me, that lucky moment was I got called into this giant casting call for what I knew was going to be a Batman movie. They were very secretive about it, and I auditioned for one of the clown bank robbers. And Christopher Nolan ended up deciding that he wanted me for a bigger and more, you know, I don't know what the right word is, but for a role that I got to do a lot more with. And
So
and that's how it
you were
started.
like hoping you could just like you could have this small role where you would be in clown makeup, so no one would have like probably.
No one would have recognized me. It's that bank heist scene at the top. So they're dressed like clowns. They have maybe one line each, and I would have been doing cartwheels for 3 years if I had have gotten a chance to do that. I'm not kidding. Like I was the guy who was down at the barriers when they were filming the movie, just like trying to catch a glimpse of cameras or of actors. You know, I'm that much of a nerd about this stuff. And so when I got to go and play an actual role where I had to interact in, you know, a way with these incredible actors in this incredible script in this historic film with this director who, you know, is in many regards like our generation Stanley Kubrick, it was life-changing. And I was telling your producer Chris the other day, what's fascinating about that experience is to this day, if people come up to us at the airport or at a restaurant or somewhere, and they graciously will say, "Oh, I really liked you in Ant-Man," or whatever thing, it always comes back to, "But I remember when I first saw you in The Dark Knight, and I knew that guy is crazy."
You know what? Okay, I want to talk about That Guy Is Crazy because even like, okay, watching All Creatures Here Below, your new movie that people will have a chance to see in Kansas City next week. Watching the screener for that, there is something about the way that you use body language to that is just it is really intense.
Well, thank you. I think that I am so fortunately an actor who was trained both in Kansas City on stage and in Chicago on stage with mentors and teachers that helped me understand that communicating between two human beings is so rarely done with words. And that's never to negate the importance of dialogue or verbal communication, but just remembering that if I'm saying to you right now, "Thank you, Gina," and we're sitting across from each other, the way that I say, "Thank you, Gina," with my body could be horrifying, and it could also be really warm and like grateful. So I also give a lot of credit to and thanks to John Papsidera and Christopher Nolan. When I got that role in The Dark Knight, the casting director and the director both said to me in this little room, like, "We love what you're doing. Just do it with your eyes and put it in like your belly." And I knew that from my training, but I just hearing them say that, because I was afraid maybe I wasn't conveying enough information to the camera, I started to trust that. And luckily it's a tool that works really well for me when I'm trying to communicate what I think the character needs to be saying.
You know, the movie All Creatures Here Below draws on kind of a dark side to your past, which you are exploring, I understand. Was working on this film kind of a healing process for you? I know we just have a little time, but I hope you can kind of get into a little bit of that.
Sure. I think talking about anything, be it, you know, trauma or, you know, mental illness, psych issues, depression, any of the things that we as a society have been, you know, taught to keep hidden in our cupboards. And that is one of the harder things that I found about growing up in the Midwest. I think that I, especially in the 80s, it was like, "You don't talk about that stuff. Come on." So thankfully, we as a society have grown a lot. But in exploring this film, when I went to write it about 7 years ago, there were definitely some really, really, really dark you know, shadows of abuse that have haunted my family, my immediate family, for 4 decades. And a lot of that I wasn't even aware of until about 7 years ago. And when everything came to the front and came out, it was pretty devastating. And a lot of stuff that you bury can wake up in really scary ways. So writing this film and dealing with these themes was absolutely therapeutic, nothing, for no other reason than getting to talk to you today and getting to know that hopefully somebody listening who may have survived either psychological, physical, sexual abuse as a child is willing to just listen and talk about it, then that in itself is therapy. The filming of scenes and working on character, I've personally never found necessarily to be like psychologically does much, because in those moments I'm manufacturing something that I need to convey a really important idea to an audience. So the therapy I feel like happened around the shooting of and creating of this film. And even just going back home, I wish we had time. There's a moment we showed up on a location that I hadn't even scouted, which happened to be one of the most traumatic locations of my childhood. And I couldn't believe that of all the square miles in the city of Kansas City, that this team had picked this one stretch of road, and it kind of took the wind out of me. But it wasn't so scary once I was just driving down it. I was like, it's just a stretch of road. And that's all it is.
And it sounds like in the moment of performing and acting, you're focused so much on craft that the content loses its power.
Absolutely. That's what works for me. It's different for every actor, and that's the magic of acting, I think. But I tried a route early on, especially in my stage work in Chicago, because I have been an individual who's battled and dealt with depression and a lot of things, good and bad. But I remember trying to really, like, quote unquote, feel them, for lack of a better term, while I was performing a scene. And I found that to be, like, for me, it was a fool's errand, because I was chasing something that never felt as authentic as it did back in the real moment when it happened to me. So what I learned to do was use the skills and techniques for vocal modulation, physical, inhabitation, eyes. I mean, with Jensen in All Creatures Here Below, I did a really ridiculous amount of work on muscular eye control because I felt like
it was effective. Those
well,
were
thank
some
you.
Crazy eyes.
And I felt like it communicated what I wanted to say about Jensen. And if me internally is thinking, God, I really hope that my right eye is catching the light here while I'm showing this face that needs to look scary, but Gina watching the film goes, that dude looks scary, then I've done my job.
Well, David Destmulchin, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you. I hope to see everybody at the Kansas City Film Fest next week.
David wrote and stars in the new movie All Creatures Here Below. It'll be screening here in town April 12th as part of the Kansas City International Film Festival. The screening is at the Cinemark on the Plaza, and there'll be a Q&A with David Destmulchin. So, yeah, pretty cool stuff. I am Gina Kaufman. Our next guest is getting ready for this weekend's powwow in Lawrence. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now we're going to meet Gerald Miller, the Wichita tribe elder who's been building a grass dwelling outside the Lead Center for KU's annual Powwow and Indigenous Cultures Festival. Gerald Miller, hello.
Hello.
This is something you're doing for the powwow, which starts tomorrow. Are you done, or is there more work awaiting you?
We finished on a Tuesday.
Congratulations.
Right. Thank you.
Can you describe what it is you built and how you did it?
Okay. What we built last week was a arbor-type house. We started to build a bigger house, but we got rained out. We had three, four days of rain in Lawrence, Kansas, so the ground was really saturated. So when we start digging into the ground with the post hole diggers, we pulled up nothing but mud. So we start thinking we better start, you know, getting ourselves together. And so the dwelling would, stand up because the ground was so wet. So we had to downsize our house to a smaller house. but is still built in the style of the Wichitas.
What is exactly a grass dwelling? Like the significance to Native culture and also, really, it sounds like to your family in particular?
Yes, it was a survival for us. They were built long time ago. They're ancient houses. They were made of grass. Some were 20 feet to 50 feet in diameter and 18 to 20 feet high. They were made of a framework of poles covered with grass thatch. The beds were arranged inside on elevated platforms. And there was a fire hole sunk in the center of it with a smoke hole in the roof at one side. They also constructed arbors beside their houses, which provided shade and places to dry corn, buffalo meat, and pumpkin, which they braided before drying. They made mats and hung them on the walls for storage. After they were cured, 5 years later, you could put them in water and then you could eat them. The Wichitas, they raised large quantities of corn grinded in wooden mortars and stone meatis and trade surplus to the neighbors. And so what we did, we made one of the arbors for the Lawrence powwow.
Can you explain what an arbor is? So the arbor is the other term for the grass dwelling.
Right. So you had a roundhouse, then you got an outside house called the arbor. It's like a summer house. The sides are open. It's like a big canopy. And that's where the Wichitas spent their time in the summertime.
Was your process building this essentially the same as how people used to do it back when these were made to be people's homes, when they
Yes, everything was originally done just like they did back in the old days.
Can you tell me more about yourself and your background, what it was like growing up for you in the Wichita tribe?
Oh, yeah. I was born in a house between Anadarko and Gracemont, Oklahoma, on April 1st, 1947. We used to bathe and haul water from a little creek called Sugar Creek. It was only about 100 yards from our house. We didn't have any electricity, gas, water, air conditioning or TV, no modern convenience like we do now. And our family, we had to do farm work on the farms, because that was the only work that was available to us. Since my folks didn't have any trade, skills, or education, I started to work when I was 6 years old. I can still remember that. I was in the cotton fields with them, helping them, you know, support the family. Then I joined the Army at 17 years old, served 3 years in Europe, got back in 1969. I served with the 1st 87th Light Infantry Company. That's part of the 10th Mountain Division. And I left my home in Anadarko about when I was about 25. Then I moved up to the city. I went to school a little bit, but I didn't graduate from high school, but I got my GED in the service. Attended Oscar Rose Junior College, got 2 associate degrees, 1 in sociology and 1 in psychology. Attended Oklahoma University for 1 year, and then my mother got sick, so I had to stop and went to doing odd jobs. I finally ended up at the Norman Veterans Center in Norman, Oklahoma. That's a long-term care nursing facility for veterans. I stayed there for 27 years and retired as a supervisor.
You are now considered an elder of the Wichita tribe. What does that mean?
At my age, there's only 3 or 4 full bloods, and I am one of them. So that's what they consider, you know, the elders.
What is the meaning of that as like to your heart?
To my heart, you know, I feel good inside, but then again, I feel kind of sad because, you know, it's just that feeling I get, you know. I used to see my elders a long time ago, you know, talk to me and, you know, say this, you know, just kind of give me wisdom and stuff like that. But now I'm at that age, and it's kind of sad, but again, I'm kind of happy too.
What is, just within a tribe, what is the role of an elder?
Well, the role of elders to teach the younger ones what we did long time ago and guide them. got them in the right way.
So when you brought community members together to build a grass dwelling in Lawrence outside the LEED Center, because it's not just you building it by yourself, you got the community sort of, you rallied people to join you. Is that part of you, what you consider that role?
Oh, yes. I came out there to guide them. There were a lot of volunteers that came out there, and we all worked together as a team. Certain people were cutting grass, and others were out in the woods getting the poles that we needed to build a structure with. And then other crew was getting willows, so we really had about three crews going.
And you did all native grasses, right?
Yes, ma'am. When you do a grass house, you got to have a blue stem, switch grass, or lake grass. If you do lake grass, the outside of the house is more corrugated, and it's a tougher, you know, material.
Where did you learn all of this? Who taught
Me?
You?
Well, I learned how to build grass houses from my uncles and my aunts, especially my uncles, Frank Miller and Wallace Miller. They were really, they really helped me out learning this stuff. Frank and Gladys Miller, they built the grass houses at Indian City in Oklahoma in the 40s and 50s. They had some huge houses out there. It was a tourist attraction. And that attraction lasted for about 40 years. People go up there all the time. Every time they come to Oklahoma, they want to say, let's go to Indian City. So that's the place they went. And the reason why it lasted so long, 34 years, because they had maintenance on that house. Anytime you have a grass house up, you got to pull maintenance on it.
What does that mean?
That means like upkeep on it.
Right, you know, but like, how do you do that? What is it that you do to take care of a grass house? Like if you were to, in the old children's story, there's like the three little pigs and the wolf comes and huffs and puffs and blows the straw house down very easily. So like grass house in my mind, like that doesn't sound like the sturdiest material, but you're talking about grass dwellings lasting
for a long time. Yes. Yes. Ours are tied onto the frame and it takes a lot to blow that grass off, and it stands up against all the weathers that we have. But sometimes we get some real bad storms, and so we have to go back in there and rethatch it again and retie it again, maybe put up a pole or two, and that's what we call maintenance of the house.
Man, this weekend is KU's big powwow, which they have every year, and it's a really big deal. What is that event like? Have you gone to powwows your whole life? And yeah, I'm curious about this one and where it stands like in your experience.
Okay, every Sunday I went to a powwow when I was growing up, because the Wichitas, they all would get together on Sundays and have a big powwow dancing. They all meet, all the families would get together. But, you know, since the family's kind of splitting up now, they don't hardly do that. But when I come up to Kansas, I see all these Indians back together, and it makes my heart happy again to see everybody work, you know, pulling together to like to have that big powwow out there.
Is the dancing something that you enjoy?
Oh, yeah. I used to dance a long time ago when I was a teenager. But, you know, I guess I outgrew that. Stopped building houses.
Yeah. What are you most excited about when you look at the grass house that you have built that people are now able to see?
The feeling, or something like the feeling you get.
Describe it.
Yeah, I get a like exhilaration feeling, you know, starting out, you know, I have to go to the woods, find the right type of woods. They're not measured or nothing. Then I have to go to the grass, see what kind of grass we got, if it's thick or not. But anyway, it all comes together and I get that great feeling of joy in my heart.
That is awesome. Gerald Miller, elder of the Wichita tribe and builder of a grass dwelling outside the LEED Center in Lawrence, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Okay, thank you.
The University of Kansas Powwow, an Indigenous Cultures Festival, is April 6th, which is tomorrow. It's free. It's open to the public. Events begin at 11. Grand entry times for the powwow are 1 p.m. and 6 p.m. And again, that's tomorrow. That's it for today's show on Central Standard and for the week. Go to kcur.org/centralstandard. If you missed any of the shows you'd hope to catch, the location of Kansas City's baseball stadium, nerding out over 80s movies, 3.2% beer in Kansas, these are all things we have discussed this week, and those conversations are available at kcur.org/centralstandard. You can talk to us on Twitter anytime. We are at KCURCST. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Chris Young, Coy Duggar, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day. And our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman, over and out.